December 24, 2021. It's a walk from Pedro show.
I saw a picture of you with a flute.
Yeah.
Are you playing that too now?
I'm learning.
You're always learning, aren't you?
I hope so. I'm always trying to learn.
I looked at the Downbeat Critics poll 2 years in a row, and both years I noticed this, that the European critics are much more in favor of the new music than the American. Almost, say, 50% or 60% of them would vote for new musicians,
yeah.
Whereas only, say, about a quarter of the American. Is this what you found in Europe? Is this what you found outside the United States, that your music is more favorably received by the critics, the power structure, shall we say, than in the U.S.?
Well, I tell you, in the new music, I believe in that. And when I say the new music, I mean most of the younger musicians starting out. I know that they definitely have found a quicker reception in Europe than they have here. And when I started it, it was a little different because I started through Miles Davis, who was an accepted musician, you see. And they got used to me here in the States. Now, when they first heard me with Miles here, they did not like it.
I remember that.
It's just one of those things. Anything that they haven't heard yet, and it's a little different, at first, they're going to reject it at first. Now, but the time, it will roll around, the time when they will like it. Now, the States, by being here with Miles and running around the country with him, they heard more of me here, and consequently, they became accepted before they did in Europe, because they hadn't heard me in Europe. But we found when we went to Europe the first time, well, it was a shock to them there, you know, like they booed me and everything in Paris. Because, it is, you know, they're ready for this. But now I find the last time I was in Europe, it seems that the new music, they're really, you know, they open up, man. They can hear it there better than they do here.
Large Joshua and Francisco. Represented the expression constantly. And expense abolished desire musical. Legislature the attending fortnight. A nearly absent morning, did I? Undo constantly of the fraud as now. Should you be willing, please me arranging. Universal abused expression. Having been absent. A February remedy. Next appear order hereby. There hall the me emperor. California and laws which exist integrity. Represented throughout. Hereby, Commander-in-Chief, receipt force. A body the most effective. and laws proper throughout represented. Hope is you. Yesterday.
For Pedro Show, happy Friday. Start off, John Coltrane talking to Frank Kosky, November 66, about always learning. Imagine that, John Coltrane, always the student. Something to think about. Then Gino Robert with Proclamation. Because of them Estonian software people with their Skype invention, I got with me Gino Robert. Welcome aboard, Gino.
Thank you very much, Watt. Glad to be aboard.
Absolutely.
I have a Coltrane story about that. Anthony Braxton, who I worked with a little bit, told me he went and saw Coltrane back in the 60s and at some point during a break went to the bathroom, and he goes to the bathroom and Coltrane's in there still playing. He just always shredding. And it's, you know, that actually stayed with me. The same thing. It's like, you know, you're always learning.
Yeah, there's Miles Davis in the Quincy Troupe book, he talks about after gigs they're chasing dope with women. And he's up there practicing. I mean, he had a dope thing, too, for a while, but somehow it's probably the music that got him through that shit. And the year I was born, he quit it and got better, which Richard Meltzer said was a big deal for the movement at the time. Because, yeah, you could quit and get better. You didn't have to be fucked up like Bird. Richard Meltzer said he kicked dope out of the temple. So, Bird, I'm curious with your music journey. So can you please bring your earliest musical recollection, Gino?
Yeah. You know, my parents listened to two kinds of music, you know, country and Western.
Both kinds. And
I was raised in Riverside, California, not
all
far.
All right. Yeah.
Not far where you are.
No, about 90 miles east from Pedro. And Chris D from the Flesh Eaters grew up there.
No way. I didn't know that.
Pitchy way. That wouldn't fuck jive you, Gino. I mean, he came to Hollywood early, right, to help run Slash and the Flesh Eaters. Big guy with movies. Had a lot of knowledge of movies. Also, Bruce Duff, Riverside Cat. I remember playing a pad out there called Spanky's, I think.
That's right. That's right.
Right. And a guy, maybe a Lebanese cat.
Yep.
Great cat. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also the school. There was a venue called The Barn.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yep. That was the scene. It was Spanky's and that.
Okay.
But, yeah, so, you know, I grew up in that world, and my parents used to say that I'd take the pots and pans out when I was, you know, before I could walk and hit them with the wooden spoon. So, you know, that was kind of, I just liked sound.
That was the gateway.
That was the gateway. And
on YouTube.com, there's a half hour documentary on Elvin Jones, John Coltrane's drummer for a lot, right? It's called Different Drummer. And that's how he started.
No way.
Peachy way. And, you know, and that's his sister helped him with money and his paper route. And that's how he got his first gig.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, at some point, I think I was asking for a drum set, and I got one, like this kind of toy one, like one of seven. And
I mean, like paper heads.
Yeah, and my cousin stood on one of the drums and, you know, put his foot through it. So eventually, they got me a one of these sort of made-in-Japan small plywood kits, and I just kept at it. And
well, besides that, those incredible drum sets you acquired, was there any other musical instruments in the pad you grew up?
You know, my father played guitar when he was a kid, so he occasionally would pull his guitar out and try to show me, you know, G, you know, the cowboy chords.
Yeah, sure.
And so I had that, and then, you know, at my folks, my mom's side is Hungarian, my father's side is Italian, so at weddings there would be accordions and violins. But, you know, no one ever showed me what to do. But since I played drums, I got to sit in and, you know, follow them. So
I think it's the same colors. One's sideways, one's up and down.
Totally. Totally. So that was, I mean, that was the, but, you know, I didn't have any, at the time, I didn't have any musicians in the family or anybody who, you know, did it professionally on this side.
Sure, sure. I'm just curious because, you know, a lot of people have different paths to get to where they are now, you know. And they're all kind of unique, like fucking fingerprints. But then there's a lot in common, too. Like, what was the first record you bought with your own money?
First record I bought with my own money was Paranoid by Black Sabbath.
Black Sabbath, second album. Okay. And first gig you saw?
first, like, rock star gig? Or
just, you know, music. Well, you said the Weddings, right?
Yeah, but I was a real... at Disneyland, it would probably have been Buddy Rich.
Wow, you saw one of... Because those gigs are notorious, right? That he gets scissored for smoking mota.
Oh, my God. And they were endless. I mean, they were just like... He'd be on stage, and they, I guess they would have 45 minutes, but they wouldn't end. They would just go. You know,
oh, man, those gigs are notorious. You got to witness one. Oh, man, I've read all about that shit. Also, we know about the bus gig. What about at school? Were you in the choir, the marching band, or shit like that?
I was
that?
In the marching band, and I was... I play in the orchestra, a marching band. I had a piano teacher in junior high school, and he led a choir at a Baptist church, so I played drums with them. So
I'm curious about the marching band.
My first paying gig was when I was 14.
Marching band. I want to know what did you do? Did you do traditional grip?
Yeah, we did traditional grip, and we did all the choral.
Oh, so you played like a field drum, either a tom or a snare? Yeah, because yep. I tell people that it's slung on your side. That's why the match grips later with trap kids.
Oh, totally, absolutely. And there's, you know, there's certain things you can do with traditional grip you can't do with, you know, with the match grip. If you watch the old drummers, the way they play those fills,
you know,
they're easier and they're more fluid when you're playing the sort of traditional grip, because it's just laying, the hand is just laying there doing that, and it's really, you know, it's quite a bit of a jump.
Bill Bateman, the blaster drummer, man, he plays traditional grip, but he flips the port side stick up the other side, so he's playing with the fat.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And you know trap, right? Where it came from, New Orleans, right?
Oh, totally, yeah. Absolutely.
Contraption.
Yep.
Yeah. It was just put together, right? Cobbled from all kinds of shit.
And if you look at those pictures, each drummer had a different setup.
That's right.
Sometimes they had to make their own. It turns out, I learned, the other thing in my story is I found out when I was 30 that my mother, out of 8 kids, is the only one born from a different mother, right? She was born out of wedlock because it turns out my grandfather, when he was, you know, in his 20s, was an itinerant violinist in Saskatchewan, and he had met this woman, and he had an affair with her and had my mother. But he was in a group where his cousin played the drums, and that he had to build his own drums because they were out in the sticks. So
right, Saskatoon people, Saskatchewan.
Yeah,
it's like prairie, actually, Canadian prairie.
Totally, up north, beyond Regina. So
right, north of Winnipeg.
So he would have, you know, his cousin would skin feral cats and use the skins as the drum hits, right? You just, okay,
that's DIY.
That's totally DIY. Yeah, that's punk rock.
That's Walt Whitman with leaves of grass.
Yeah. So every time I see a picture of an old drummer, I think, God, you know, did they have to make, what did they make that head out of, you know?
Well, Hodges, you know, the guy I did my first opera with, he used calfskin heads for his kick drums.
Yeah.
It's on a couple of Tom Waits albums.
Right. It's a different sound. And, you know, it's funky because the minute somebody turns on the lights in the studio, the heads go flat because of the heat, you know?
Right.
So you really have to baby them and be on it, because even as you're playing, they're changing, you know?
Oh, yeah, because we tuned into the tunes and the parts of the album.
Totally.
Yeah, and so it took a little bit with that kick. Okay, so what about the thing after school, not graduate, but in the afternoon, bedroom band, the garage band, the basement band? Did you do that stuff?
Totally. Just go home, friends would come over, we would try to figure, you know, as we're learning how to play the instruments, it's like write our own tunes, jam on them. You know, you find those two chords, you play them for 4 hours.
You know? American Woman.
Yeah. You know, it's just,
fucking 4 hours every day. That one part, that's a one part song.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, and you're happy as a clam because it's just.
Because you're with your buddies and you're fucking doing it.
Well, it's meditation. It's, you know, your whole body is in this, you know, your heart rates are all the same. It's really just the best. It's hard to explain to a world that lives on the computer.
Right,
you know?
right. And, you know, everybody's a product of their sitch, but then there's the thing about reacting against the sitch.
Yeah.
Now, you guys were like me and D. Boone copying off records, right? But did you start composing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because
we didn't. We didn't until the fucking movement.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't shit you. Because we're 13 in 1970. It's arena rock. I really, truly believe the movement was anti-arena rock. It wasn't about beats per minute or funny haircuts.
Oh, no.
Those were involved, too.
It's totally about that. It's funny you say that, because I was in when I formed a punk band, because up to that point, I was playing, you know, cover tunes, and we would play, like, Neil Young and whatever people wanted to hear.
Winnipeg. Guess who?
Well, this would have been Riverside. This would have been
No, but you're referencing Canadian Prairie. Exactly. I did too. I said, guess who? American Woman.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No kidding. But yeah, so it's interesting. I always liked to improvise as a kid and just sort of fuck around and things, and then I would find something and I just, hey guys, let's just do this let's play this for a while. So those kind of would work themselves into tunes. And I'm surprised it took you guys a while to do that because...
No, because nobody was doing it. Not one person Pedro wrote their own songs. The best guy in music in Pedro was the guy who could play Black Dog the best.
Mm-hmm.
Look, you gave me this open secret. I want to play that.
Right. If you could clear a certain amount of land from trees, you could keep it, right?
Right.
And so it's really going to attract people who are that dedicated and that really tough and willing to, you know, tough it out. So then you have, you know, it's like Australia or like the United States. You have all these people who are really, you know, individual and can suffer. You know, they can live through suffering in order to make a life, you know, and that creates a certain world.
Yeah, I believe it.
You know,
so did any of these garage bands, did they do gigs?
Oh, yeah, we played gigs. I was playing in bars at 17 because two members of the band were, you know, in their 20s, and they were able to get us in.
Do you remember your first gig?
Yeah, actually, my first gig was, my first bar gig, yes. And my first gig was at the only time I ever played a New Year's Eve party. I was 13, so...
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what were we playing? We were playing like, you know, cowbell rock.
Okay. Now, through school, you know, a lot of you were doing this on the side with the rock and roll, but then at school you're learning this stuff. I assume you were in the orchestra, so classical and maybe even some jazz, the marching tunes and all this. Now, after school, graduation, do you go to higher education for music?
Yeah, because my piano teacher had been at University of Redlands, and then the mother of my girlfriend had studied at the University of Redlands. They said, really? Because I was going to go to UC Riverside, Riverside City College.
Yeah.
because, you know, I was already playing in their orchestra and their band because they needed percussionists. They said, oh, no, you got to go to university, and they had this great program. So great. But, you know, I wasn't a very good student, but somehow musically aptitude-wise, they could see, okay, this guy would be successful. So I got into U of Redlands through that, spent 4 years there, and that's where the first punk band I started was there, but also got to play a lot of contemporary, you know, music, worked on composition. So that was for, you know, it was full of really creative, freaky people, which was really great.
Speaking of which, I should have said what we just played. Open Secrets with Spoonwink, then Miriam Jendon from Montreal, 31-10-2011. Simon Grab and Francesco Guidici with a brand new I Leave. Thomas Prendon, Sequintet. Samuel Locke Ward with Bog Organs, brand new out of Ireland. This Is All. And then Pink Mountains, one of your projects, Over the Rainbow Somewhere. That's a twist. Okay, to continue on. So you got this parallel universe. You got the punk band, and the punk band's doing original songs, right? Mostly.
We're doing some originals, but not. We're the lead keyboardist, singer, Andy Rayfield, had perfect pitch. So he would do this thing with whatever song was a hit for the day. We would do a punk version or a reggae version.
Of course.
And it would usually be, he would just say, call it out. He'd say, you know, do you want to hurt me? And we would just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, but good thing you didn't call out Tarkus.
No. Well, thankfully he didn't do that. But, you know, it was more just to shit on the
hits. Yeah, I understand. People forget about that. You know, the movement came because the hippies kind of lost their humor. There was a lot of funny shit in our movement.
Oh, my God. For me, it was actually quite revelatory. I saw the Minutemen play in 84 at Cal Arts at a Halloween party.
That's right, with Replacements. And I remember the singer making fun of me. I was dressed as a clown, and I said, well, yes. What are you dressed as? A rock star?
what was amazing about the Minutemen is, you know, I had a couple of the records, but when you played, it was like prog rock, because it was like your transitions between sections was so...
Yeah, well, we tried to make it like it was one song, right? But the idea was actually from Wire, Little Songs. We thought people wouldn't know that we learned from Blue Oyster Cult and Creed's.
But it was, you guys were just so on fire. And I was just, my mouth was, you know, open, like, oh, my God, that's where punk, for me, that's where punk needed to go, was to just be fluid and not this sort of blocky, you know, short song. So it was quite, you know, one of those moments in my life where I just went, yeah, here we go. There's the key.
Well, D. Boone's take on the movement. In fact, a skater from Arizona, Robert Locker, made a sticker out of this. He said, punk is whatever we made it to be.
Totally.
And people forget that's what it was about. It wasn't like a competing brand. It was just like a geo for Ideal World.
Well, yeah, you want to start playing music, but you don't want to have to be in that bullshit business.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. And parallel universe. So what happens after 4 years? You get your thing. I mean, you made some connections there, right?
Yeah, I made some connections, but I moved to England I moved to London to hang out with these people who were just doing free improvisations, just to get an idea.
Oh, the Derek Bailey AM thing?
AMM.
Yeah.
Actually, I went there to
So how'd you get turned on to that? The people at school?
Yeah, one of the graduate students was friends with the guys in AMM. So she's, you know, said, hey, write him a letter.
Keith Rowe with the guitar on the table.
Totally. And I wrote him, I wrote Eddie Prevost a letter. He says, what are you going to learn from me? You have a degree. I'm like, well, I just want to see what you're doing. Because their lifestyle was really fascinating. It was very much DIY. You know, he had his own label. He did his own festivals. He published his own, zine and things like that. So I was like, I want to check that out. So I spent a year there. And it was, you know, again, really eye-opening.
You know where I found out a lot about him? Rob Chapman's book on Syd Barrett. Syd Barrett was really influenced by those cats. And you wouldn't know it.
Yeah,
they shared
the stage. I mean, that's the thing is, again, you have a scene where it's not, there's no, those pigeonholes haven't been created yet by the media, you know?
Right, or industry.
Yeah.
What's it called? Genre or bins in the chain store?
Yeah.
I remember the punk in those days. our punk stuff, you know, import bin, right? Well, imported from Lawndale. Man, it was so trippy in those. They were so afraid of this shit. Why? It was.
I mean, they so must weird. Have been selling copies. Why would they be afraid of it?
You know I know, mean? I don't. Well, later on, look, they tried, right, this thing called Alternative, 15 right. years later, right? But anyway, we can't settle scores. But you went to England, you learned a bunch of stuff from, you went to the well. You didn't just read about it, you went to the cats.
I no, like, I totally, and I it, like was, it was really humbling. I didn't play drums, I sold my drums here, I moved over there, I didn't play drums for an entire year. Okay. I didn't play any percussion. Okay. I just went to gigs.
And when you and came had, back, what'd you do?
Well, when I came back, I met Anthony Braxton when I was out there. I went to a gig and saw him play, and I went backstage and said, hey, I was, you know, was just talking to him about his work, and he asked me, he said, what are you doing? I said, well, you know, I'm here just hanging out. I'm a composer. He says, well, you should come to the Bay Area because I teach at Mills College. And
oh,
you
wow.
can do anything. He says, you can do anything you want. I'm like, really?
I heard they saved that school. It was going to close.
Well, that's a whole other story. I don't want to go into that.
Okay, we won't. But yeah. I'm interested. The composing part was this another thing from Redlands?
Yeah, this is. I mean, it's one of those things that I was really into trying to figure out how to. How to compose in a way that made sense to me. And
what I'm saying is you're out of the role because drummers are supposed to be stupid. Not you know, Chico Hamilton couldn't get songwriting credits.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. Is that. Yeah, there's
the
another...
notes are too short. They don't last long.
Exactly.
Fucking dicks. You know, especially with rock and roll and stuff, with beat music or jazz music, you know, jeez.
But when you're in marching band, you're writing cadences and you're
writing
session ensemble pieces. Absolute. And I got way into them.
Four-string guitar bass, or is bass really a four-string drum set?
It's totally a drum set.
Look, we're at the end of the first hour, December 24, 2021, special guest, Gino Robert. Hold tight for hour two! December 24, 2021, it's the second hour of the What? Pedro Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Walk for Pedro show start off the second hour with On a Persian Rug from Pink Mountain, then Molom, now Balmore, Fragmentation, brand new out of Berlin from Hack Di Picciato, Journey East, and then finally Tender Buttons with What Is the Current That Makes Machinery That Makes It Crackle. Now, enlighten us about this Pink Mountain, because you gave me two of these tunes.
Pink Mountain, the members of Pink Mountain got together just to sort of improvise in the studio. Let's make a record of free improv, and Sam Coombs is a singer that is in a band called Quasi.
Yeah, with the Janet, ex-wife.
Yeah,
on the
Janet, exactly. And so we're improvising. I'm like, this isn't going anywhere. Let's improvise some songs and then, you know, have Sam sing on them. So we kind of reoriented things, and that's how both records came about. We would improvise until a song appeared, and then we would, you know, kind of trim off the things digitally.
Like the Miles Smiles and On the Corner, that stuff?
Oh, totally, yeah. Okay. You go Teo Macero to these things.
Right. Now I ended up doing the Saccharine Trust when they had me aboard with that World Broken record. And Open Secret?
Open Secret was a project where, you know, the three of us had played a gig and thought, oh, this is a really great...
Three of us. Which three
this
of us?
This is a nice trio, yeah.
Which three of us?
Oh, okay, so that's John Butcher on saxophone.
Oh, yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah, and Deep 13, Turntables, he's from Vienna, he plays noise turntable.
Sure.
So, you know, and that session was a birthday present to John Butcher when I was in Britain. We went over to Rack Studios and just spent a day there. And he's doing this feedback sax thing where he's, you know, he's got the mic and the bell and the speaker in front of him. And he's just moving the keys and doing the feedback thing. So it fits really well with what I do, which is take apart the drums and they're laying all over the floor. And I'm putting motors on them and, you know, stacking them and stuff like that.
You're putting motors on the drums.
Yeah, I have these like little motorized, like you would think they were like vibrators and dildos, but they're actually pencils. They're these like battery operated pencils, and they jump around. And so I put an Evo on the snare drum, on the snare of the snare drum, to play it to make a sustained sound.
Okay, here's another proj: Wong, Robert, Bosie. I'm assuming it's three cats.
Yeah. Thank you.
And they bought us drinks.
Oh, that's beautiful. You were really so polite, weren't we?
Wow. Goes without saying.
Yeah.
Now, it looks really fucking posh down here. But this is where I was born. Oh, I'm fucking posh.
Thank you.
Walk for Pedro show. Yeah, that chunk of music started with Wong, Robert, Bozy, with Zero Beat and the Reaction Set. Sounds like the band was Zero Beat and the Reaction Set doing Wong, Robert, and Bozy. Then Cotolis with Hard Luck Story in 39, Ray Shin, As Little As It Takes, and then Wong, Robert, Bozy again with Unsafe As Milk, which I'm going to take a wild guess here, but some kind of reference to Captain Beefheart's first album.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Which Ry Cooder made happen, right? He even did his bass on a couple tunes.
Yep.
Abizel. Yep. Yeah, yeah. And another lyricist we find, a Mike Barnes book, very good on the Captain. In fact, you can go through every fucking tune and watch, listen to it on the YouTube.com as you're reading about how it was recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a trip. And, you know, all 12 records, 17 years, 43 versions of Magic Man. So, enlighten us to Wong, Robert, Bozy.
Well, I've been playing with Bozy for a while. He lives in, at the time I met him, he lived in northern Italy, in Torino, but now he lives in Marseille.
Okay.
And Francois Wong lives in Marseille, so I was visiting them for another project, visiting the town, and we got together and thought, wow, let's record.
Yeah, of course.
We're together, let's hang out and record. And it turned out some really great music, you know.
Okay.
I mean, usually when you get a drummer, a guitar player, and a sax player, you play, you know, people will play time and they'll play songs, but that didn't happen with this band, so.
Time. Well, you know, the thing about, I think, what, you know, the last recordings of John Coltrane with Rashid, I don't have to worry about chord changes.
No.
Yeah. And I think even that earlier with Miles with the, you know, kind of blue. They had exhausted that stuff with the bebop, and, you know, let's try this. I don't know, modal. Some people get upset at that word. You know, I forgot to ask you about Tender Buttons.
Oh, yeah. So Tender Buttons is Tanya Chen, a British pianist who specializes in Cage and Feldman, but also improvises. And then Tom Dill, who's a trumpet player.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah.
Great,
and so he and I are playing a lot of electronic music together in real time, like live synth patching. And when Tanya moved to town, I thought, let's get together and do a jam. And it was so much fun that, you know, we started a trio and we played quite a bit for, you know, over the years.
And you mentioned time. You know, in that documentary I told you about with different drummer with Elvin John, he said people didn't want to play with him because his sense of time, I think it was more like the ocean, right? It was in swells.
Yeah. It's just really interesting the way he plays because it's not – you know, people say, oh, yeah, you know, he's swinging. But, I mean, it's really hard to play the way he plays, especially in those classic Coltrane records. And it's the same thing with if you listen to the early Stones or mid-period Stones and early mid-period Beatles, it's really hard to play like Ringo in those early records because it's not straight eights and it's not swung eights. It's a sort of this in-between world. And that, for me, that era of drummer, that era of rock drummer, Bill Ward had the same thing. They're still
Bill Ward, incredible. Right? You mentioned Paranoid, and what a jazzy swinging fucking thing. I know it's hard rock, but oh my god,
those records. I know those records are like jazz records when he does his fills. They're just like all over.
Oh yeah.
But you know, it's like you can't play straight eights in any of those with any of those early records because those guys are still they still have jazz in them. I mean,
Tell me about Charlie Watt. You mentioned him because the only time I ever saw him in person was at an Elvin Jones show. Me and Raymond saw.
Oh, really?
And he was with Les McCann. Yeah, he was wearing three overcoats, and he was with Les McCann. And Les McCann was in a wheelchair yelling at Elvin, "Come on, you motherfucking play!" The whole gig. Elvin was smiling a lot. But Charlie was watching him like a hawk.
You know, Charlie would – that's the great thing about being a super-duper rock star on tour at that level is that, you know, you have those down moments. And Charlie was voracious. He would go to gigs wherever he was a jazz gig, right? I mean, he was totally on that stuff.
And what did you hear in the early Stones about his drumming?
What was that again?
Would you hear in his early Stones drumming that tripped you out, like Ringo and shit?
Well, it's just the swing, you know, that's not straight up and down eights.
That thingy, a lot of signature, like get off of my cloud.
Yeah. But you know the funny thing is that it's sort of like that band is Charlie Watts trying to learn how to be a rock drummer and not always succeeding. So there's some records that you hear him play and you can hear him just flail, trying so hard to like line it all up, and he's not. But it's that tension that I find really exciting.
I tell you where he's got it happening, street fighting, man. I think that's recording on a cassette.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that drum is so bitching in that tune.
And I think that, you know, the Beatles, too, is like, you know, I haven't watched Get Back yet, but...
Or even 70s. What about Can You Hear Me Knocking? That's a drum lick.
That's it. I mean, there's still these, like, the band trying to do these things, and, you know, they're probably giving him feedback, and he's, like, trying to do what he wants to do, and there's that tension.
You know about the Olympic Beggar Banquet, right? Jimmy Miller... Sympathy for Devil, you fucking play it. And Jimmy, the producer, is a man.
Oh, my God, that movie is so difficult to watch.
I know. Very
uncomfortable. Drummer, you know, you just watch it, you go, oh, painful, painful.
So okay, so what about, you know, we're talking about improvised music. And I ask this question to a lot of guests that do this stuff. Is repetition an enemy of the improviser?
No, not at all. Okay. I mean, you got to find that moment when it fits, you know.
Because the drummer, right, he's putting together these motifs where you kind of repeat things.
Sometimes, and sometimes you know, the kind of improvising music I like is when you can't tell what instrument is making what sound.
Ah, okay.
You know, so repetition's okay, but if the sax player is making a sound that sounds like a drummer, the last thing I want to do is sound like a drummer, so I'll
try to
make it sax.
So the band is always listening to each other, trying to make an interesting conversation.
Yeah, no, and I think conversation is exactly it. It's like you go to a party, you don't go to a party... with a list of conversations, you know.
Talking points.
Yeah, okay, let's see. We have to have this conversation about, you know. No, you don't. You do it like we're doing right now. You just, things happen, and you roll with it, and you listen. And
one thing leads to another, and it's dynamic.
Then sometimes you just think, wow, that was really amazing conversation. Other times you think, I don't ever want to see that person again, you know.
Now, okay, improvisation, We'll speak no more of that. Now, we were talking about composing, right?
Yeah.
Is improvising a type of composing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the million-dollar question when there's not $1 million around. but, yeah, I think it is, you know. But composing is like, oh, I have an idea. Let me save it in perpetuity on this piece of paper by drawing songs. But records, you know, records allow us to... or
capture moments of composing in the moment.
Yeah, but you know when you're playing a solo, you're composing it, right? You're hearing what's going on, and you have a vision of that's developing in that moment, and you're following it. And some people don't think they can do it, but you know you can fool people into doing it, and then they realize, oh, that's all improvising is, and you go, yeah, that's all it is. You know, we're improvising when we're talking to each other, and once you get And classical musicians, sadly, are often, you know, trained.
You know, when I talk to a classical musician about improvising, they have to say the word jazz. They can't say, but I had one guest, I can't remember the name, actually said there are some improvising traditions in classical music. They go back to, I don't know, the fugues and stuff. It was all mathematical and stuff, but you could, like, fool around with the form a little bit. And not just total machines.
And the great composers like Beethoven.
Yeah.
You know, he was an improviser. I mean, when you read contemporary, you know, reports of him as a musician, you know, he was comfortable improvising. People in that era in the 19th century were comfortable improvising in a cadenza. There was a moment
That's
when...
That's it. That was the
form. Yeah, the violinist at the cadenza to show off what they do, you know.
Right. Thank you for saying that. Look, we're at the end of the second... Or reminding a slow learner what... We're at the end of the second hour, December 24, 2021, and just Watt Peter, so special guest, Gino Robert. Hold tight for hour three. December 24, 2021, it's the third hour of the Watt Peter.
Thank you. Ha ha ha!
Walk for Pedro show. We start off third hour with Mitten Butcher Robert. Sounds like another three-way. A simple man with irregular habits. Then the equations collected with cut 1.3 point. And then Trobokova Krishnapeci with Lutka, which means doll in Slovenian. Live at Muziki Benali Zagreb. So 1983, this wasn't Slovenia. It was Yugoslavia stuff. And then something, you gave me three tunes from the Splatter 3 plus N. And this is Butter Churner. So in likeness to Splatter 3 plus N.
Well, Splatter Trio was a band that I was in actively for about 10 or 11 years. And we started to invite people on stage and just have a big band thing. And that's why that's the Splatter 3 plus N, because the number of people would change. And
ah, okay.
So we went to the studio again, improvised for a while, and then did a Teo Macero on it. And this record, 10 years later, that record with Butter Churner came out with cutting and pasting things, adding people, subtracting things. So it was a very much our kind of on the, you know, early 70s Miles period version of what we did.
And I'm guessing that the titles come after?
Yeah, oh yeah, totally.
Well, not totally, because Watt has to have a title first, so he can't write a song. But I always ask people that because nobody fucking does that. And what we started off with, this other trio thing, Mitten, Butcher, well, you know the Butcher guy, right? And Robert.
Yes, Phil Mitten is a singer in England as well, trumpet player, who goes way, way back. I mean, he was in a rock band, an amazing set of rock bands in the 60s and 70s. And he can do things with his voice that other people can't do. So it's just, if you look up Phil Mitten on YouTube, you'll find some really amazing performances. So,
and how'd you meet him?
I got to meet him and record with him. Just like, oh.
Yeah, but how? Was it just a coincidence?
Oh, it was John Butcher suggested it.
Oh, okay.
I was in England for a festival, and he, you know, I said, let's go to the studio, and just since I'm here, he says, well, let's try something with Phil, because he played with Phil for many years. It's,
yeah, it's about people. You know, people ask me about the old days. I say it was about people. I think the new days are about people, too.
Oh, totally. You know, and that's the great thing about being a musician is meeting people and not just going out for dinner, but maybe jamming, making some music, and sometimes you resonate, and sometimes it's a fun time, but you don't resonate, and I mean, that's the joy of it. I mean, certainly you're not in it for the money, you know.
But, is there ever a dilemma of when you get the jam going, who goes first?
No, not with the people I play. It's more like, I mean, I'm lucky that the scene that I play in, everyone has kind of a shared value system. Like, you know, if I was to work with people who are into Brazilian, deep Brazilian music, you know, I would have to understand the rules, right? Or at least have an understanding of what they think the rules are. And in this improv world, I kind of know what John and Phil think, because I sort of share that thought, and we, you know, we just get in play, you know. And what you're hearing on that CD is not exactly what we played, because we didn't put everything on the CD. We picked the choice parts, you know.
Absolute. It was kind of a, yeah,
but there's no overdubbing,
Teo, you know, thing. No, but it's a Teo thing. This original stuff, and then you,
yeah, but in that world with the free improv stuff, we don't overdub, whereas with Splatter 3
plus, oh, you do overdub with Splatter. Okay.
Oh, totally, yeah, that one. I play keyboards, I added...
Because there's kind of different things, right? There's a thing where everything's a jam, and then you cut up the jams. But then there's stuff where you add to the jam.
Yeah, so with Splatter 3 plus N, I think it was Butter Churner where, you know, when we recorded, it was just the rhythm section, and the guitar player at the time, Len Patterson, threw in a lick. I'm like, wait a second, that's the melody. So I kind of built a melody out of what he played, and then it sounds like we composed it. It's just like, wow, that worked.
You know? Okay, that's the point, kind of what I was trying to get at, you know. At the end of the day, it's the sound coming out of the speaker. And I say this a lot, Frank Morgan in Wizard of Oz, pay no bad attention to that man behind the curtain. He's behind the fucking curtain.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, no one wants to go to the sausage factory. Never eat sausage again.
I mean, that's the genius of people like Teo or Frank Zappa, is like, they, you know, like Frank could take a guitar solo from 20 years before the recording session, and, you know, he's in the middle of a recording session and realize, oh, if I put that old guitar solo on top of this, it'll fit. Right. I mean, you're kind of like thinking, you know, across a long field when you're producing a record, because you're thinking the listener's not going to be in this room. They don't really give a shit who's
the authenticity.
Yeah, they want to hear good music. And so, you know, you have to keep that in mind. And same with improvised music. You know, you can document what happened. That's fine. But if you sort of mold it a little bit, it becomes more of a satisfying aesthetic experience, you know.
You know, there is a technique in movie making with the one shot, right, with no editing.
Oh my God, totally. And, you know, it's like, and Hitchcock would, Rope, I think it is, you know, when they ran out of film, they would pan across something, like a box,
right,
or a wall, and that's where they would put, you know, that's where they would make the edit. So it was almost seamless, you know, and if you didn't know that, you would think it was all one shot, but, you know, that's how they would kind of, you know, blend those two, you know, have to change the reel kind of thing, which on a computer is, I guess, change the hard drive.
Oh, man, he was so much into the experience of the film. He had this idea of the MacGuffin, the subject ain't even important.
No, totally.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, you gave me some more Splatter 3, or I should say Splatter Trio Plus N. Yep. Nevada, I want to play.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pedro, last music for this edition, Splatter Trio Plus N with Nevada. Then we had Viv Corringham with Al Margolis to Jasper John's Number 3. Yeah, I play a lot of Al Margolis. He's been on the show twice. Chester, New York. Incredible cat.
Yeah. Cool.
Tripe Soup with May 19, 2017, 01. This is out of Montreal. And then finally, the Mumbler, Splatter Trio Plus. Who's the Mumbler?
Or no.
Remember Dick Tracy? But one of the crooks was Mumbles,
right? Oh, my God,
right?
The Mumbler. Terrifying. No, this was another, this is one of those tracks, because the rhythm track was separate, and then I had, the sax player from Splatter was going to move to Mexico, so I brought him into my studio, and I just had him improvise and recorded him on DAT tape. And then when we did this Mumbler track, it didn't have any melody, and I just kind of took one of the, you know, one of the solo sax things and plugged it on, and it fit. So, you know, it's one of these things that you just need to have a lot of material, a lot of paint around you to kind of make a, you know, make a picture. So that worked out okay.
Well, let me ask you about composing. Do you compose ever on the drums?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
What's that about? Like in the marching band with the little figures?
No, it's more like, you know, I get a sound going or I get a rhythm going, and I think, oh, yeah, I like that. Now what do I do with it? You know, how do I develop it? Where does it need to go, or where did it come from?
And do you do traditional scores or graphic scores or what?
I can do, yeah. I can notate it traditionally. A lot of times it's just notes, but sometimes there's a rhythm, there's a way, you know, there's something happening that I want to really remember. So, you know, I'll write it in traditional notation. But then, you know, it's like a puzzle. Where did it come from, and where is it going to go? And you have
right.
to figure.
Because some of these electronic cats, right? They make kind of artworks, drawings.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, computers can do all that kind of stuff. They can take a drawing and sonify it, and vice versa. You can take, you know.
So that's a whole nother angle at composing, right?
It is. It is, because, you know, once it's on a computer, it's just ones and zeros, and
right,
you can
absolutely
turn that into anything.
But there's something about organic, natural sound too. I mean, at the end of the day, it's stuff coming out of the speakers. Pay no attention.
Totally. You know, you just have to, you know, if you remember that and you're thinking about the listener, or if you're just doing things that really turn you on, there's probably going to be other people that really enjoy that as well. You know?
Yeah. I think it's a fucking essential fabric between us humans that ain't so fascist. You know, if you don't like it, just turn it off. Nobody's got food on your throat or shit.
Yeah.
Where can people find you on the internet?
GinoRobert.com.
GinoRobert.com, people.
Correct. And Bandcamp, there's a Bandcamp page for that.
Well, you probably got all kinds of links at your site, right?
Not yet. I'm updating the site this holiday season.
Okay. And what's next on the table, on the cooker, the oven?
Oh, my God, today I'm editing some music from a performance in London from 3 years ago with a keyboardist named Steve Beresford.
Okay. It was just a duet?
It was a trio with Steph Horak, who does vocals, processed vocals. So it was live electronics.
Okay. And you're mixing it?
Yep, I'm mixing it. Actually, no, it's mixed. I'm editing parts of it and then okaying the masters, and then a label in the UK will put it out.
And is there any Gino Robert projects in the works?
I am, yes, it's funny you say that. I am working on another version of my I, Norton opera. I'm finishing that up, and I have
I, Norton? Is that something to do with Emperor Norton?
Yeah, exactly. So it's taking the...
I found out about him through the Discordians when I was a teenager.
Oh, you did? Oh, my God. Yeah.
Principia Discordia, huge effect on Watt.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
That was one humor part of the hippie thing that I brought over to the punk movement.
But yeah, so Emperor Norton published decrees. He decreed that a bridge be built between Oakland and San Francisco. So I took all his decrees and made an opera about it. But the opera's improvised. There's very little music. It's all kind of instructions on how to put together improvisation with a group, and if you want to use the text, you can, but you don't have to. So
that's building a bridge. I heard they wanted to put a plaque on the new Bay Bridge for him.
They wanted to rename it the Emperor Norton Bridge, and there's people who don't want that.
Yeah,
come on, man.
lighten up. Look, I mean, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so when they published in the 18th century, or 19th century, when they published, you know, come to San Francisco brochures on the East Coast, it also included Come See America's Only Emperor.
Right. I think he had his own currency.
He sold bonds. And he sold
That's
bonds.
It.
But he sold bonds for $10. Now think about how much $10 was in like 1860.
Big time.
You're right. So, but he died the year they all came due.
Right, but he used to, there was some, he got, people would chow him and stuff. I mean, he was an essential part of the town.
Oh, totally, yeah. No, he lived it. As in an impoverished life in a, you know, a resident hotel, but, you know, he could eat for free anywhere he wanted to eat, so.
Right. Look, when you get that happening, will you come back on the show, play it, and we can talk about it?
Sounds great.
Oh, man. Big honor. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation.
Keep on keeping on. People, been December 24, 2021, edition of Watt Pedro. So keep your powder dry.